I would like to really thank Carlos for inviting me to come here today and to present this collection of films or videos that are really, really important to me. I also would like to thank Travis and Ryan and also Duncan and everybody at the New Museum who made this possible. And I'm also extremely happy that two of the artists in tonight's program are actually with us. So Benny Nemirovsky-Ramsey and Ali Rodriguez are both here tonight. So, and they will be with us. Yeah. And we will get to talk with them a little later on. The way this is going to be working is I'm actually going to be introducing briefly each project before actually show it. So it's a little bit of a lot of me talking and then little clips of stuff. So I'm sorry, bear with me. Also because I'm trying to stay on time, I'm actually going to be reading. And I'm a little dyslexic and a little French Canadian, so it might come out a little difficult. But bear with me. Okay. When Carlos asked me to curate a screening in relationship to his exhibit, I decided to create a program that looks at queer folks' struggle with traditional conceptions of marriage and family, and explore different avenues based on friendship, community, and contact with strangers. There are tons of films and videos that deal with this subject, from numerous point of view, from Jenny Levinston's Paris is Burning, to Wu-Tang Wildness, very recently. The selection I made is very personal. There's actually a lot more work that I would like to have in here, but these are all videos that resonate with me as I'm presently working on a documentary on my own unconventional family by choice in Montreal. And I have to say I'm very excited that some members of my family are actually in this room. So yay. And but before that, the video that's actually playing right now, that was playing when you were coming into the room, is called The Faithful. It's part of an installation that is presently up at the Sullivan Gallery in Chicago in a group show called The Great Refusal that was actually curated by Ali Rodriguez too. It's a project that I shot last summer at Touché, and Touché is Chicago's oldest letter bar. It's part of a reflection on kinship based on community and friendship that's greatly inspired by an interview with Michel Foucault, later published as Friendship as a Way of Life. In the interview, Foucault invites us to think about what kind of relationships can be established, invented, multiplied, modulated through homosexuality. For him, and for many of us, I think, homosexuality lends itself naturally to friendship. In The Faithful, most of the participants in the projects are colleagues, former students, friends from the bars, from the gym, and former lovers turned friends. The participants are all different background, a different age, race, body type, style, but they're all engaged in an intense game of seduction. The two screens are never positioned next to each other like they are tonight, but rather one in front of each other in a dark space. And since the number of film portraits is not the same on each side, there's six men on one wall and five on the other, when the installation loops, each man will be cruising a different partner, creating a queer utopia where everyone desires everyone. And of course, bypassing the usual narrative of falling in love with the one, getting married, and later divorcing when the illusion dissolves. So speaking of illusions dissolving, I am going to start with a really... I'm trying to go chronologically through time with these different videos that have influenced me. Okay, so shot with a Sony Portapak video camera in the early 70s, The Continuing Story of Carolyn Furt is a groundbreaking video documentary soap opera. Broadcast on PBS, the series of first attempt at reality TV produced before an American family. The video was also presented as a multi-channel video installation at The Kitchen here in New York at the time. Carolyn Furt are in love, and they want to get married, like everybody else. Carol is an experimental filmmaker and sometimes porn actress and director. Ferd is a bisexual junkie. For better or for worse, they've decided to clean up their act and get married.
Yeah.
So this is an hour-long piece, and of course I don't have the time to show you the whole piece, but I'll show you a couple of excerpts. In the first clip, introduced the characters living in San Francisco, and these are a very happy time for Carol and Ferd.
All right. Though many friends, for all sorts of different reasons, including trying to protect the institution of marriage, tried to discourage them from getting married, Carol and Ferd decided to go on with the ceremony. Their televised wedding turns into a media circus where the guests in the living room can watch on the monitors the orgy in the bedroom between the newlyweds, some friends, and the video crew. And now we will actually pick them up a few months after the wedding, as Carol and Ferd have moved away from San Francisco and are now living in Evanston, a suburb of Chicago. Okay, assimilation in the mainstream dream of middle America was not the magic solution that they had hoped for, but rather a one-way ticket to depression. In San Francisco, they lived surrounded by friends and lovers in a liberated and creative environment. It was a chaotic and drama-filled existence, but one in which they felt alive. In Evanston, Ferd reinvents himself as a straight man, but quickly Carol realized that this new person has nothing to do with the man she loved. At the same time, Ferd realized that he does not love Carol, not in a conventional romantic way. They soon separate, and Carol creates a life for herself in academia, in film study, in criticism, while Ferd becomes a social worker, a writer, and an active member in many activist groups, including Chicago Gay Liberation Front and ACT UP Chicago. Later in his life, he also created a web alter ego called the Cranky PWA. Ferd passed away a couple of years ago from liver cancer complicated by HIV. The next video, Danny, Basta Shukiberta, brings us back to the peak of the AIDS pandemic in North America. Kiberta's video is radical in many ways. It offers us a complex and frank portrait of an HIV-positive gay man who is also an intravenous drug user. Danny is presented as a man who is, regardless of his advanced illness, still sexually active and sexually desirable. This was incredibly daring for the time when fear and hysteria were so prominent. I would almost say it still is pretty daring, unfortunately. The AIDS pandemic made one thing crystal clear. Everyone needs a strong support system and safety nets. For lots of people, this meant a return to your family. But for many queer folks, like Danny, this was far from an ideal situation. His mother takes him back and cares for his body, but she reintroduces him to an environment ruled by shame and secrecy, where everyone, including Danny, protects the feeling of the homophobic father. The filmmaker can only wonder why Danny decided to return to this place instead of staying with his friends. Danny's a 20-minute film, short film, so we're actually gonna watch the whole thing with this one. Since then, a lot of films and video have highlighted the contribution of the community in supporting and caring for each other. A good example is the recent documentary we were here by David Wiseman and Bill Weber that looks at the community response in San Francisco in the early years of the crisis. Of course, to say that all families are close-minded and opposed to a queer lifestyle is incredibly reductive. Some families are very supportive and understanding, and some families do not fit the preconceived notions attached to the term by conservative member of society, and some families are queer. Oli Rodriguez is the product of such a family. As an artist, he explores the reinvention of the self through investigation of family dynamics and childhood games. I will talk about two of his projects. The first one is a work in progress, the Papi project, that will soon take the shape of a hybrid photo and video installation. And for this project right now, I only have photos, so we'll look at photos and I'll talk. Like Carol inferred, Ollie's parents were married for a hot minute. The relationship fell apart when Ollie's mother realized that her husband was having sex with men on the side. It's a longer story, but I won't tell it. But somehow, after all the drama, they managed to remain good friends and created a loving and supportive environment to raise Ollie and his brother. Ollie is part of an extended family. Both parents found lifelong companions. The family also incorporated many friends and lovers. The family is diverse and fully integrated. We'll go down on that. As part of the project, Ollie will explore his family's photo archive to get a better understanding of his unconventional family tree. In his family album, photos of birthday parties and new haircuts are juxtaposed to snapshots of gay pride parade, Christmas parties, countless family pets. I just had to put cats in there. And lots of people dancing and having a good time. I'm not going too fast, but... Ollie recognized some of the people in the photos, but not all of them. The project gets more complex. In order to reconnect with some of these strangers and to gain a better understanding of his dad as a sexual being, Ollie posted an ad in a few cruising websites. It reads something like this. I am looking for men who had sex with my dad. He was known as Troy, Peter, Pedro, and other aliases in the late 70s, 80s, and early 90s, before his death from complication due to AIDS in 1993. I'm his son, and I want to hook up with you. I'm open to a drink, dinner, or other ideas. Below is this picture. If you had relations with him, please contact me. The project was a little bit of a failure, but an eloquent failure, as they often are. Ollie found only three men who claimed to have known his father. Using his iPhone, he shot his encounter with them. Two of them ordered him around, and I will leave it at that. Ollie is here, he can talk in detail about the project. While a third one had a long conversation with him about the disappearance of a whole generation of men, including his father. Ollie decided to also interview his mother. She talked about her former husband, the impact of the AIDS crisis on her family, and her strong ties to the gay community. Ollie often jokes that his mom is also a gay man. In another section of this multifaceted project, Ollie traveled to many gay cruising sites that his father visited before him. For Ollie, this project allows him to mourn his father and to get a better understanding of a man he never got to know as an adult. So the project is, of course, coming up, but I felt it was a really important counterpart to Danny, so I really wanted to include it in here. In another project, though. Okay. As an F2M artist who now identifies as a gay man, Ollie never got to experience the masculine, almost social rites of passage associated with childhood team sports, and we all know that these can be very pleasant. At the age of 27, Ollie created the Baseball Project, in which he infiltrates a local baseball training program for boys 18 and 12 in order to re-experience his childhood as a boy. He asked a friend to act as his sister and videotape the practice. Ollie then watches the footage with his mother, one of his usual collaborators, while gossiping about the experience. Once again, the mother is a positive force and an inspiration for like the queer artists. In no way is she shocked or fazed by any of this trespassing, as she lovingly calls her son a good phony. Subsequently, Ollie reenacts the footage with a group of queer friends, creating a utopian space free of the pressure of heteronormativity found in organized childhood sports and blurring the usual gender code. Once again, this project was actually created as an installation. So it's just supposed to loop, so it's not like there's a real ending or anything. But we'll watch the whole thing. It's about, I think, 7 minutes, five minutes. Okay. And of course, at the end of the program, Ollie will also come and we can continue the discussion about his work with him. Over the last few years, many queer artists have produced videos that focus on promiscuity and the relevance of contact with strangers in response to more conservative ideology of the gay mainstream movement. Radical works like Play Pause by Sadie Bennings and Community Action Center by Iggy Burns and R.L. Steiner are loyal to the politics and philosophy of early gay liberation movements by putting the emphasis on the fleeting, the experimental, and the unknown over more stable and normative arrangements. Benny Namorowski Ramsey's Legacy is another example of a piece that mines the archive of the gay and lesbian movement to reinvest the present with radical ideas from iconic gay thinkers such as Andrew Harvey, Harry Hay, Quentin Crisp, and Andrew Rahmer. The piece, once again, was conceived as an installation. So the video is meant to be projected on a singular screen specifically designed to match the ornate shape of the video, but Benny was very nice in accepting that I show it as part of this program. As part of the installation too, there's also a special edition artist book that's also available as a companion piece. I have a copy here, and Benny has a few copies too if ever you're interested in looking at that after the screening. In the video, a lonesome figure wearing a mirror mask is wandering through an enchanted forest, a mythical and mystical space of cruising and self-discovery. The protagonist encounters four oracles that urge him to not imitate his adversaries, but to rather turn differences into possibilities. What we're going to actually do with this, so this is a 12-minute piece, so we're actually going to watch the whole piece. And then once we're done with that, I will ask Benny and Ollie to come to the front, and then we're going to switch things around where we're going to have more of a conversation between us and with you guys. But first, here's the video. What I would like now is for Benny and Ollie to come maybe sit at the edge of the stage, and so we can have the conversations with you guys. The edge of the stage is yours.
I'll give you this.
No, I'm not gonna play me.
I'm gonna ask you questions.
Okay, maybe like to start the thing before you have questions. Maybe I'll start the ball. Let's say. I'll start with Benny since we just looked at your piece. I'm curious. I mean, it's not really a question. It's more I'd like for you to talk a little bit about the process of like the writing process of like sort of collecting all of these pieces, both the oracles, the main character, the decision to have the sort of battle cry at the end, and how you reappropriated all these texts to create like a new text, and how those things work as a dialogue for you.
Was that one question?
That was one long. I'm from the Barry Patton School of asking questions. Talk about writing.
First of all, it's great to be here. Thank you, everybody, for coming out. It's really nice to see that video because it is really rarely screened, so I actually haven't seen it for a while, and it feels good. Most of my work involves singing, and singing is sort of the starting point of a lot of my video work. To be honest, I became aware of auto-tuning software, and this YouTube video is called Auto-Tune the News. And I thought it was a great concept, but the content was really bad. I thought it was in the wrong hands. And I just thought, like, what if it was really amazing, radical, inspiring ideas being turned into music as a way to transmit ideas broadcast ideas that, especially as queers, a lot of us have not learned, have ideas that have not been passed from generation to generation. And so I sort of went on a quest of my own looking for material that I'd like to try to turn to music. And it actually began with a quote from the film about Harvey Milk, the Milk film, in which Harvey Milk's character tells a young fag that he's going to meet all of these extraordinary men, that he's going to meet so many of them, sleep with so many of them, that he, at the end of his life, he won't know which were his greatest friends and which were his greatest lovers or something, which to me was this incredible piece of queer wisdom that was especially queer. It wasn't a universal idea. And this sort of triggered a bunch of searching for ideas that felt sort of uniquely relevant to queers, said by queers for other queers to understand ourselves. And then to try to turn it into music. And I wanted it to be some kind of queer dialogue between characters, and I don't know, it's hard, like there's so many parts to your questions. The Cruising Ground felt like the perfect magical enchanted setting for that kind of an intergenerational dialogue to take place, this kind of geography that is not a geography. And then the battle cry, well, and then the other texts, the mirrored masked man, everything that he says is dialogue from films, it's gay characters in films. And the screams at the end are also various people, including that gay boy on Glee, I don't know what his name is, Kurt from Glee, and Jimmy Somerville. And I mean, it's a real mixture of different things that go on in other videos of mine, sort of coalescing into one sort of magnum opus, I suppose.
And like your decision to use like for the four oracles, those four writers, like what was sort of the drive like to pick them instead of other people? Are these people specifically important to you, or was it the way they worked together?
Yeah, I guess both. I mean, they were texts that felt very strong. They were ideas that I would love to have resurrected for contemporary queer audiences to think about. Mm-hmm. Ideas that felt radical and lost, ideas that were not part of contemporary gay consciousness, in my opinion. There were more, like the Harvey Milk one, but I had to string them together into some kind of a narrative. Mm-hmm. And these were the ones that got selected, you know, to have a kind of narrative arc, I guess.
Super. I'll ask another question and then I'll pass it on to you, because I want to ask Bobby a question. I want you to talk a little bit about the decision, the baseball project, to actually decide to reenact the baseball training. So you did this act of like, you know, going in undercover, but then you actually decide to add this other layer of meaning by reenacting that. And I want you to talk about that process, what kind of layer of meaning emerged from the reenactment.
Thank you, Farik. Hi. So in terms of the piece, on the right was the actual performance space. So that was the actual raw footage where I played 8 to 12 year old baseball for about 6 months, twice a week, 2 hours each day. And then on the left is where your kind of question lies, where I decided on, from the hours of footage, which actual scenes, because I kind of break it down in terms of like batting intensive and throwing intensive and failing miserably at all of it, and having that reenactment in terms of thinking about community and agency and power, and kind of, it was a redoing for sure in terms of this, you know, adolescent experience again, but I feel that when we bring it back as adults, they all are, in a sense, reenacting their own adolescence, which, you know, can vary from, in terms of experience, from the negative to the positive, and, you know, quite a spectrum in between. But I think we all came together in terms of, like, the project to do it together. So I wasn't just the only one reenacting. They were essentially as queer-identified folks and ambiguously gendered and whatnot doing it with me. So it was all like a collective, I think. Mm-hmm. Queer family exchange.
I guess now would be a good time if you have any questions to ask. We have a little bit of time for a question and answer. There must be one.
I'm curious actually to ask you if in the sort of the queer reenactment that happened afterwards, if the space that you created, I mean, was everybody just concerned in sort of choosing a boy from the team and reenacting what they were doing, or did you find that this became a really, like you said, the negative and the positive aspects of this performance and their own adolescent associations with sports was given a stage to play out, and I wonder, like, did unexpected kind of, dare I say, like, cathartic moments or traumatic moments, like, it seems like a really potent space to have created, even though the goal was to recreate your experience. I'm wondering, like, what the mood was and what the atmosphere, because it feels really charged. I can imagine it being very charged for a lot of the participants.
For sure. I think it was, to a certain extent, quite emotionally charged. I mean, I did bring everyone little bag lunches, and I think I kind of set the performance or the shoot up in terms of shooting quite playful. So I think that was kind of where the tone I was going for. But in terms of, I had them watch it first. And I think a lot of the policing that occurs through adolescence, where we don't actually have control over our own bodies, we're told what to do, we're monitored from school to organize sports to, I mean, even by our own parents. So I think in their initial viewing of the footage, and again, this was quite a longer piece initially, so I had them watch about 45 minutes to an hour, and I think theirs were more of the cathartic moment, because we actually could sit down and talk about the reaction to some of the comments, like, you're throwing like a girl in the gendered language, or the persistent failure no matter how good someone is, because you always have to be better. So I think there was one of the moments. But in terms of the shoot, that definitely was a lot more playful, and they were, took on the characters of the boys. And I think they had a lot of fun.
Thank you very much for everything so far. I guess the question could be for all three of you. I think there was a really beautiful and generous, not generous, a really beautiful thread of HIV throughout the programming tonight. And I'm wondering if any of you want to talk about the ongoing impacts of HIV in creating other arrangements and in creating family.
Do you want to know?
Is this a threesome?
It's a threesome.
I mean, I'm still formulating.
I think in terms of my project, at least, specific to my project, I think that the idea that there is radical queer ideas from the past that have not been transmitted from one generation to another, you can't talk about that, you can't think that way without it being clearly about the generation that was wiped out, either by actually dying or by the kind of silencing that took place or the kind of shame or just the way that the queer community was reconfigured during that time, and that there was this huge interruption in terms of who are our mentors, who are the elders, how do ideas move from generation to generation. And so I think that that's part of, that informs my motivation of trying to like reconnect a link over the void of history, over the void of people. I mean, I don't know if that directly answers your question, you know, but I think that was very much on my mind as I sort of went searching for the ideas that the radical, incredible, touching ideas, important, transformational ideas that felt lost to me.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I'm 40, so like really like growing up in the middle of the pandemic, you know, like all of these sort of issues about illness were so present, and like thinking, okay, well, who would take care of me? Who will take care of my friend? Will I be there for my friends? Were so important. And I think in a lot of ways, I think when I was in my early 20s, I wasn't somebody who was very political, but friendship was this thing that was really important. And I surrounded myself with these people who I knew were there for me, and they're still there for me, and I think we have these sort of exchanges that are really important. And so it became sort of a really important moment of growing up in that moment, and I think that's why I'm so interested in this topic of queerness and family, because it's not, I mean, I have to say, I'm super lucky. I love my biological family, but I also have this other family that is just as important to me. And I feel I have all this, I have this incredible support system, but it's also something that I've been thinking about so much through all of my life, you know. So I think AIDS actually had a lot to do with that. It was growing up at that moment.
In the Bobby Project, which has a lot to do with looking at the AIDS epidemic, pandemic, pre-internet, and from mid-80s. I mean, in terms of the project, it is something that, in terms of family, is synonymous with HIV or AIDS. And so I think that was one component, one facet of the project, is seeking out those that have lived through the pandemic and potentially had some contact with my dad. And so the failure of that, which we talked a little bit about, or Frederick mentioned, was one conversation I did have, who was with a man who by the end identified as being positive, and talking about the cruising landscape, and how that has altered. And I'm really interested in thinking about technology as being definitely facilitating that, as well as the AIDS epidemic. Thank you.
Thanks for the program. It was riveted by everybody's presentations. I have a question about rehabilitation and idealization, in the sense that I actually saw Danny when it first came out, because I'm older than the movie. And I actually I'd forgotten it, but I used to show Carolyn Furt to my undergraduate class. And I knew Furt a little bit. So I'm interested in this returning to this particular moment, pre-internet sex cruising, because it seems to me that in both of your projects, I guess the Bobby project, is what it's called?
The Bobby project.
And Legacy, it seems to be, in a way, about a type of rehabilitation of a continuum that has seemed to be broken. Okay. And in doing so, I think that, I mean, I think they're very interesting. I think they're, you know, emotionally very rich. But I wonder if you encountered problems in terms of idealization. And by that I mean the danger of idealizing a particular sociality that in its context in situ is actually very conflicted on many levels. So yeah, that's just basically the question. How do you negotiate with that?
I allow myself full rein to idealize. I mean, when you say it that way, I see the inherent problems of doing that, of sort of looking romantically into these historical texts and reframing them in the image that I want to see them, and to imagine mentorial figures that I didn't have, or imagine spreading this carefully manipulated, turned into song information that is not mine, and broadcasting it in this fantastical, how can anyone not love it, way, you know? So I think that's the part of the problematics that you're flagging, I guess. I didn't encounter any, well, I didn't, I just enjoyed myself doing it, I guess. I didn't think about the question while I was making it. And I think that that was probably partly because as part of my own personal process, this is what I was looking for. These were the ideas that I needed to nourish myself and my own sense of, my own sense of historical, place in a historical context, I guess. I have to be honest, you know.
I definitely have encountered this question before, especially in a lot of the images that I'm pulling from the mid-80s to mid-90s. I'm not going to deny the romanticization or the idealization at all, but I also think of it as a continuation in terms of my own lifestyle and identity. And just to go back to the term Bobby, it means father or dad, but it also can be a term of endearment. But it also can be an object or objectification. So like, hey, Bob, you know, kind of like a sexy term. So in terms of the question, I don't think it just stops narrowly as this fetishization of this time era, but also an homage, a continuation of lifestyle, I mean, an identification. But I hear you, I do, and I've heard this. And it's something I do struggle with. But I also think in terms of going back and looking at some of the cruising landscapes and also the images that he has taken, I think of it almost as a curation. It's not necessarily, I think, my own work, but a collaboration. And then the new work of myself engaging in dialogue with with folks is definitely, it doesn't combat it, but I think it adds a bit more than just the idealized, like, look at this. So yeah, thank you.
Well, and I think that the placing the ad in, as part of the Puppy Project is about really reaching out to the real people and hearing the real stories. It's not so much about an idealized framing of your father's life or these images. I think I'm maybe more guilty of what you're talking about.
I'm not accused.
No, I think it's a good question. I mean, another piece of material that did find its way into Legacy, in which we hear the voice of Harry Hay, one of the founding radical fairy, a fairy friend of mine handed over as a gift, sort of like 4 hours of amateur recording that was done at the second radical fairy gathering in 1980. And somebody had just done their own recording and sort of narrated a little bit and then just sort of recorded the talks that went on, the heart circles, and other very hard to understand rituals that we only have sound to listen to. And I mean, I really like got into a trance listening to this material, and although only this one clip of Harry Hay explaining his theory of subject-subjectivity found its way into Legacy, there's all of this incredible material that, especially because it's sound and there is, at least maybe I haven't found the visual counterpart. I'm sure there's photographs taken from the same gathering. Maybe there's video film footage as well. It sort of like allowed me to imagine this, especially pre-AIDS fairy paradise. You know, it was really hard to not let my imagination and deep longing for that lost space to sort of like soar and blossom.
Yeah, also like just in curating, I mean, I'm more of an artist than a curator, but like in creating these programs that show a lot of these works that might have this tendency, I think there's also like a desire to look back in order to look forward, you know, and this idea of thinking that your audience is somebody who's actually intelligent and will actually see potential and be inspired and be, but also realize that things are complex. And I think even like just like the clips of Carol and Ferd, you know, I'm not sure how much it idealized it. I think it really shows us in those two clips how complex emotions are, how lifestyles are. But it's also this way of looking back in order to reevaluate what we are doing now, which direction we want to go in. And seeing, like, in like listening to this text, going, oh, what's going on with all, you know, these ideas? Is that something we could try to put back, you know, into to bring back some of those ideas and activate?
I have one more thing to say, and I realize I actually have been confronted about this before on another piece, another auto-tuned piece. There was a really fascinating conference that happened as part of the Venice Biennale, the Swiss Pavilion of the Venice Biennale, 2 years ago, called Chewing the Scenery, and it was various queer artists and thinkers who came together on various themes. And one speaker, Matthias Danbolt, who actually was here for the conference that Carlos organized, gave a paper about queer artists who, as he called it, touch across time, and who look into history for queer figures that they can use basically in the way that I am, to teach them lessons and to help us to understand our contemporary identities. And he mostly spoke about how these historical figures, how the touch across time from me to Harry Hay, for example, is always a one-way touch, and Harry Hay doesn't have the power to say, don't touch, to say, no, don't use me that way, don't use me for your purposes, romantic or otherwise, you know? So, I don't know, I take very seriously your comment.
Hi.
Hello.
I guess my question is for Ali. Thank you for coming over here and sharing your work with us. It's regarding the Poppy Project, and I was just curious about what relationship you were able to establish with your dad through these encounters that you had with the individuals that you did meet through the cruising, the cruising ad that you placed. And I guess my question, I'm asking that question because I'm thinking of my own development when I was younger, and I would always gravitate towards different writers through their experiences. For instance, the work of John Retchie, I found myself going through different cruising experiences. Thus, I guess through sharing those experiences with that writer, I was able to establish a kind of connection with that writer through experience. So I'm just wondering what relationship you were able to establish through these experiences with these other individuals, and if maybe there were any key points or events that happened in each one of those encounters that helped you establish this relationship.
Thank you. Well, there's a total of four, one of them being my mom. I will say two of them were explicitly topping encounters, so I was told I was like struck repeatedly, and the other one I cleaned. So in terms of the rules, it was I put out the ad, I cruised electronically, and they responded. They would have to come to my home, my apartment, and they would hold the camera. So that was the documentation. I think more of your question is probably less of the physical encounter, but actually with two of the more of the interviews that were happening, and one of my mom's actually engaging and talking about old cruising spaces and her connection with a lot of these queer men and family and children, which I think is often not depicted. Like, there are children. We were there. In terms of the young or younger, I guess older man, he's kind of younger than me, but we sat down and had a really great conversation, and he told me about his experience more of cruising and through the era, and that was kind of the connection I was definitely looking for. I mean, the story is definitely like where I'm meshed in mine in terms of kind of experiencing and being in Chicago at the same time and within kind of similar communities. And that's another thing as well. I mean, these are mostly working class, working poor, like folks of color, men of color, demographic that I'm depicting. And so I think the connection there was quite immediate. And we did sit down as two strangers for about 2 hours to have a dialogue around this and his interest in the project and wanting to be a part of it. Albeit nameless and faceless. Would that answer your question? Thank you.
Well, I'm also, was there anything new that you found out about your parents, or something that you saw of your parents in you at, throughout the project?
I'm not sure about the newness. I mean, essentially asking this question is asking any of you to recount of like a one-night stand like 30 years ago or 20 years ago. So I knew that this wouldn't necessarily be an actualization. But I think I learned a lot about him and his response. And I think that's what I really wanted, was a dialogue with folks that I knew that I couldn't have then because I didn't have language for it, but that I want to have now. So I did.
So we have time for one more question there.
So this is a
song?
Yeah.
This is another three-way. my question is about actualizing fantasy, not necessarily for yourselves as art makers, and not necessarily for us as viewers, but more so for the participants who acted as subjects for your work. I think in three instances, your piece, I can't remember the name of it, the baseball
Yeah. And then where in a community of your peers have come together to reenact gym class as boys, and a situation of fantastical cruising wherein the ideals of sexuality can play out in kind of magical proportions. And then I guess the ideal cruise where one is cruising the mirror of the camera and doesn't actually have to deal with the messiness of a individual in front of them. So my question had to do with how your subjects ended up experiencing the art-making practice with you and whether or not there were anecdotal experiences that they had which was a sort of catharsis for them through making this art with you.
It's about your artwork this time.
I don't think there was any. It was a really interesting day of shooting because it was all like everybody was present. There was no real direction. Instead of you're looking at the camera, and as you're looking at the camera, imagine that you're cruising somebody in a bar, and we're in the bar, but it was like new, you know. And there was no one there, and there was this really old 16mm camera that made a lot of noise. And there was my friend Shelley, who was behind the camera, and Shelley is a white woman who's about 60, and you know, so so it wasn't like this, like, so it took a lot of imagination on their parts. But the interesting thing, like, for me, like, the project is also like to connote that a lot of people. Through this cruising, through going to bars, to like hooking up, actually also become friends and, you know, become this sort of community. And then the interesting thing, for me, like one of the things I really love about that project was actually the shooting day, because by the end of the day, people were just sticking around. So we were all at Touche, you know, and we were like looking at other people, like when they're going, and we were like all chatting in the back, and it was like really like this really great moment. And so I guess that's the anecdote. It was more like everything that was behind the camera. And Andre was there too.
Yeah, we saw.
He's everywhere.
No, I know what I was saying. I think the kinds of little moments that happened for me that were satisfying was, I mean, I didn't quite create this community. This community is only created through editing together groups of usually just one or two people on camera, so it's really only edited together into this magical cruising world. But there were a lot of people, either the Oracle performers or just some of the cruising men, who were very seriously moved by the material that they were asked to lip sync to. Whether it was the men who were being these oracles, who through memorization of these texts, not only the texts, but the sort of rhythm of the voices and trying to really, that these were texts that became very important to them. And so, you know, and then some of the people who had come as extras to be the cruising men who weren't familiar with the texts and heard them for the first time on the set, you know, some people were crying. There's like a part which in the installation version where everything's really crisp and HD, you can see that somebody's actually crying. One of the cruisers is crying. Hearing the first text about a spear piercing into the same wound over and over again. And so, in terms of my sort of desire for ideas from the past to be transmitted to the current generation, I had some moments in where at least that was happening with at least my friends, you know, my performers. And so I could experience it in the world that I created for the video.
I think I spoke a little bit to the anecdotal with the baseball project, but with the Bobby project, there was quite a backlash when I ran the app for a year. I got emails that, you know, from really like essentially swearing at me and talking about how disrespectful this was and what a horrible joke, to, you know, someone I actually went and had a great dialogue back and forth with, who, you know, stated that there was health services for, you know, if I needed them at the Center of Halstead, which is kind of funny because that's where I shot the baseball project. But people were concerned by my asking, and this, the ad you saw, I went through about, you know, maybe 15 different changes. This was like the medium. Like it went from the very mundane, like I just want to meet you, to the more explicit. So it was more the response by, you know, people calling me a crazy fag, to like, who are you? Are you straight? Like, is this a joke? You know, this is awful. Like, who is this person? And somehow that's going to become definitely an archive or a book of part of it, but not necessarily to exploit and be like, you know, these folks said that, but it's more, I think, interesting in how varied they were in terms of concern for me to find an answer, like, you know, is this real?
We have to end here. I want to thank Fred, Benny, and all you.